2. My car was parked under Pershing Square where I had left it earlier in the day. I dropped money into the parking attendant, set the bug on Arterial West, got Pete out and put him on the seat, and relaxed. Or tried to relax. Los Angeles traffic was too fast and too slashingly murderous for me to be really happy under automatic control. I wanted to redesign their whole installation. It was not a really modern fail-safe. By the time we were west of Western Avenue and could go back on manual control, I was edgy and wanted a drink. There's an oasis, Pete. Right ahead. But while I was looking for a place to park, Los Angeles was safe from invasion. The invaders wouldn't find a place to park. I recalled the doctor's orders not to touch alcohol. So I told him emphatically what he could do with his orders. Then I wondered if he could tell almost a day later whether or not I had taken a drink. I seemed to recall some technical article, but it had not been in my line and I had just skimmed it. Damnation, he was quite capable of refusing to let me cold sleep. I'd better play it cagey and lay off the stuff.
Meow?
Inquired Pete. Later. We're going to find a drive-in instead. I suddenly realized that I didn't really want a drink. I wanted food and a night's sleep. Doc was correct. I was more sober and felt better than I had in weeks. Maybe that shot in the fanny had been nothing but B1. If so, it was jet-propelled. So we found a drive-in restaurant. I ordered chicken in the rough for me and a half a pound of hamburger and some milk for Pete, and took him out for a short walk while it was coming. Pete and I ate in drive-ins a lot because I didn't have to sneak him in and out. A half hour later, I let the car drift back out of the busy circle, stopped it, lit a cigarette, scratched Pete under the chin, and thought. Dan, my boy, the doc was right. You've been trying to dive down the neck of a bottle. That's okay for your pointy head, but it's too narrow for your shoulders. Now you're cold sober, you've got your belly crammed with food, and it's resting comfortably for the first time in days. You feel better. What else? Was the doc right about the rest of it? Are you a spoiled infant? Do you lack the guts to stand up to a setback? Why are you taking this step? Is it the spirit of adventure? Or are you simply hiding from yourself like a Section 8 trying to crawl back into his mother's womb? But I do want to do it, I told myself. The year 2000. Boy! Okay, so you want to. But do you have to run off without settling the beefs you have right here? All right. But how can I settle them? I don't want Belle back, not after what she's done. And what else can I do? Sue them? Don't be silly. I've got no evidence, and anyhow, nobody ever wins a lawsuit but the lawyers. Pete said,
Well, you know.
I looked down at his waffle-scarred head. Pete wouldn't sue anybody. If he didn't like the cut of another cat's whiskers, he simply invited him to come out and fight like a cat. I believe you're right, Pete. I'm going to look up Miles, tear his arm off, and beat him over the head with it until he talks. We can take the long sleep afterward. But we've got to know just what it was they did to us and who rigged it. There was a phone booth back of the stand. I called Miles, found him at home, and told him to stay there. I'd be out. My old man named me Daniel Boone Davis, which was his way of declaring for personal liberty and self-reliance. I was born in 1940, a year when everybody was saying that the individual was on the skids and the future belonged to mass man. Dad refused to believe it. Naming me was a note of defiance. He died under brainwashing in North Korea, trying to the last to prove his thesis. When the 6 weeks war came along, I had a degree in mechanical engineering and was in the army. I had not used my degree to try for a commission because the one thing Dad had left me was an overpowering yen to be on my own, giving no orders, taking no orders, keeping no schedules. I simply wanted to serve my hitch and get out. When the Cold War boiled over, I was a sergeant technician at Sandia Weapons Center in New Mexico, stuffing atoms in atom bombs and planning what I would do when my time was up. The day Sandia disappeared, I was down in Dallas, drawing a fresh supply of Shreklikite. The fallout on that was toward Oklahoma City, so I lived to draw my GI benefits. Pete lived through it for a similar reason. I had a buddy, Miles Gentry, a veteran called back to duty. He had married a widow with one daughter, but his wife had died about the time he was called back. He lived off post with a family in Albuquerque so as to have a home for his stepchild, Frederica. Little Ricky, we never called her Frederica, took care of Pete for me. Thanks to the cat goddess Bubastis, Miles and Ricky and Pete were away on a 72 that awful weekend. Ricky took Pete with them because I could not take him to Dallas. I was as surprised as anyone when it turned out we had divisions stashed away at Thule and other places that no one suspected. It had been known since the 30s that the human body could be chilled until it slowed down to almost nothing. But it had been a laboratory trick, or a last resort therapy until the 6 weeks' war. I'll say this for military research. If money and men can do it, it gets results. Print another billion, hire another 1,000 scientists and engineers, then, in some incredible left-handed, inefficient fashion, the answers come up. Stasis, cold sleep, hibernation, hypothermia, reduced metabolism, call it what you will. The logistics medicine research teams had found a way to stack people like cordwood and use them when needed. First, you drug the subject, then hypnotize him, then cool him down and hold him precisely at 4 degrees centigrade. That is to say, at the maximum density of water with no ice crystals. If you need him in a hurry, he can be brought up by diathermy and post-hypnotic command in 10 minutes. They did it in 7 at Nome. But such speed tends to age the tissues and may make him a little stupid from then on. If you aren't in a hurry, 2 hours minimum is better. The quick method is what professional soldiers call a calculated risk. The whole thing was a risk the enemy had not calculated, so when the war was over, I was paid off instead of being liquidated or sent to a slave camp, and Miles and I went into business together about the time the insurance companies started selling cold sleep. We went to the Mojave Desert, set up a small factory in an Air Force surplus building, and started making Hired Girl. My engineering and Miles's law and business experience. Yes, I invented Hired Girl and all her kinfolk, Window, Willie, and the rest, even though you won't find my name on them. While I was in the service, I had thought hard about what one engineer can do. Go to work for Standard or DuPont or General Motors. 30 years later, they give you a testimonial dinner and a pension. You haven't missed any meals. You've had a lot of rides in company airplanes. But you are never your own boss. The other big market for engineers is civil service. Good starting pay, good pensions, no worries, 30 days annual leave, liberal benefits. But I had just had a long government vacation and wanted to be my own boss. What was there small enough for one engineer and not requiring 6 million man-hours before the first model was on the market? Bicycle shop engineering with peanuts for capital, the way Ford and the Wright brothers had started. People said those days were gone forever. I didn't believe it. Automation was booming. Chemical engineering plants that required only 2 gauge watchers and a guard. Machines that printed tickets in one city and marked the space sold in 6 other cities. Steel moles that mined coal while the UMW boys sat back and watched. So, while I was on Uncle Sam's payroll, I soaked up all the electronics, linkages, and cybernetics that a Q clearance would permit. What was the last thing to go automatic? Answer, any housewife's house. I didn't attempt to figure out a sensible scientific house. Women didn't want one. They simply wanted a better upholstered cave. But housewives were still complaining about the servant problem long after servants had gone the way of the mastodon. I had rarely met a housewife who did not have a touch of slaveholder in her. They seemed to think there really ought to be strapping peasant girls, grateful for a chance to scrub floors 14 hours a day and eat table scraps at wages a plumber's helper would scorn. That's why we called the monster Hired Girl. It brought back thoughts of the semi-slave immigrant girl whom Grandma used to bully. Basically, it was just a better vacuum cleaner, and we planned to market it at a price competitive with ordinary suck brooms. What Hired Girl would do, The first model, not the semi-intelligent robot I developed it into, was to clean floors, any floor, all day long and without supervision. And there never was a floor that didn't need cleaning. It swept, or mopped, or vacuum cleaned, or polished, consulting tapes in its idiot memory to decide which. Anything larger than a BB shot, it picked up and placed in a tray on its upper surface for someone brighter to decide whether to keep or throw away. It went quietly looking for dirt all day long, in search curves that could miss nothing, passing over clean floors in its endless search for dirty floors. It would get out of a room with people in it like a well-trained maid, unless its mistress caught up with it and flipped a switch to tell the poor thing it was welcome. Around dinner time, it would go to its stall and soak up a quick charge. This was before we installed the everlasting power pack. There was not too much difference between Hired Girl Mark I and a vacuum cleaner, but the difference, that it would clean without supervision, was enough. It sold. I swiped the basic prowl pattern from the Electric Turtles that were written up in Scientific America in the late 40s, lifted a memory circuit out of the brain of a guided missile. That's the nice thing about top-secret gimmicks, they don't get patented. And I took the cleaning devices and linkages out of a dozen things, including a floor polisher used in Army hospitals, a soft drink dispenser, and those hands they use in atomic plants to handle anything hot. There wasn't anything really new in it. It was just the way I put it together. The spark of genius required by our laws lay in getting a good patent lawyer. The real genius was in the production engineering. The whole thing could be built with standard parts ordered out of Sweet's catalog, with the exception of 2 3-dimensional cams and 1 printed circuit. The circuit we subcontracted, the cams I made myself in the shed we called our factory, using war surplus automated tools. At first, Miles and I were the whole assembly line, bash to fit, file to hide, paint to cover. The pilot model cost $4,317.09. The first 100 cost just over $39 each, and we passed them on to a Los Angeles discount house at $60, and they sold them for $85. We had to let them go on consignment to unload them at all, since we could not afford sales promotion, and we darn near starved before receipts started coming in. Then life ran a 2-page on Hired Girl, and it was a case of having enough help to assemble the monster. Belle Darkin joined us soon after that. Miles and I had been pecking out letters on a 1908 Underwood. We hired her as a typewriter jockey and bookkeeper and rented an electric machine with executive typeface and carbon ribbon, and I designed a letterhead. We were plowing it all back into the business, and Pete and I were sleeping in the shop while Miles and Ricky had a nearby shack. We incorporated in self-defense. It takes 3 to incorporate. We gave Belle a share of stock and designated her secretary-treasurer. Miles was president and general manager. I was chief engineer and chairman of the board, with 51% of the stock. I want to make clear why I kept control. I wasn't a hog. I simply wanted to be my own boss. Miles worked like a trooper. I give him credit. But better than 60% of the savings that got us started were mine, and 100% of the inventiveness and engineering were mine. Miles could not possibly have built Hired Girl, whereas I could have built it with any of a dozen partners, or possibly without one, although I might have flopped in trying to make money out of it. Miles was a businessman, while I am not. But I wanted to be certain that I retained control of the shop, and I granted Miles equal freedom in the business end. Too much freedom, it turned out. Hired Girl Mark I was selling like beer at a ball game, and I was kept busy for a while improving it and setting up a real assembly line and putting a shop master in charge. Then I happily turned to thinking up more household gadgets. Amazingly, little real thought had been given to housework, even though it is at least 50% of all work in the world. The women's magazines talked about labor saving in the home and functional kitchens, but it was just prattle. Their pretty pictures showed living working arrangements essentially no better than those in Shakespeare's day. The horse-to-jet plane revolution had not reached the home. I stuck to my conviction that housewives were reactionaries. No machines for living, just gadgets to replace the extinct domestic servant, that is, for cleaning, cooking, and baby tending. I got to thinking about dirty windows and that ring around the bathtub that is so hard to scrub, as you have to bend double to get at it. It turned out that an electrostatic device could make dirt go spung off any polished silica surface, window glass, bathtubs, toilet bowls, anything of that sort. That was Window Willie, and it's a wonder that somebody hadn't thought of him sooner. I held him back until I had him down to a price that people could not refuse. Do you know what window washing used to cost by the hour? I held Willie out of production much longer than suited Miles. He wanted to sell it as soon as it was cheap enough, but I insisted on one more thing. Willie had to be easy to repair. The great shortcoming of most household gadgets was that the better they were, and the more they did, the more certain they were to get out of order when you needed them most, and then require an expert at $5 an hour to make them move again. Then the same thing will happen the following week, if not to the dishwasher, then to the air conditioner, usually late Saturday night during a snowstorm. I wanted my gadgets to work and keep on working, and not to cause ulcers in their owners. But gadgets do get out of order, even mine. Until that great day when all gadgets are designed with no moving parts, machinery will continue to go sour. If you stuff a house with gadgets, some of them will always be out of order. But military research does get results, and the military had licked this problem years earlier. You simply can't lose a battle, lose thousands or millions of lives, maybe the war itself, just because some gadget the size of your thumb breaks down. For military purposes, they used a lot of dodges. Fail-safe, standby circuits, tell me three times, and so forth. But one they used that made sense for household equipment was the plug-in component principle. It is a moronically simple idea. Don't repair, replace. I wanted to make every part of Window Willie which could go wrong a plug-in unit, then include a set of replacements with each Willie. Some components would be thrown away, some would be sent out for repair, but Willie himself would never break down longer than necessary to plug in the replacement part. Miles and I had our first row. I said the decision as to when to go from pilot model to production was an engineering one. He claimed that it was a business decision. If I hadn't retained control, Willie would have gone on the market just as maddeningly subject to acute appendicitis as all other sickly, half-engineered, labor-saving gadgets. Belle Darkin smoothed over the row. If she had turned on the pressure, I might have let Miles start selling Willie before I thought it was ready, for I was as goofed up about Belle as is possible for a man to be. Belle was not only a perfect secretary and office manager, she also had personal specs which would have delighted Praxiteles, and a fragrance which affected me the way catnip does Pete. With top-notch office girls as scarce as they were, when one of the best turns out to be willing to work for a shoestring company at a below-standard salary, one really ought to ask why. But we didn't even ask where she had worked last. So happy were we to have her dig us out of the flood of paperwork that marketing hired girl had caused. Later on, I would have indignantly rejected any suggestion that we should have checked on Belle, for by then her bust measurement had seriously warped my judgment. She let me explain how lonely my life had been until she came along, and she answered gently that she would have to know me better, but that she was inclined to feel the same way. Shortly after she smoothed out the quarrel between Miles and myself, she agreed to share my fortunes.
"Dan, darling, you have it in you to be a great man, and I have hopes that I am the sort of woman who can help you."
"You certainly are."
"Shush, darling. But I am not going to marry you right now and burden you with kids and worry you to death. I'm going to work with you and build up the business first. Then we'll get married."
I objected, but she was firm.
No, darling. We are going a long way, you and I. Hired Girl will be as great a name as General Electric. But when we marry, I want to forget business and just devote myself to making you happy. But first, I must devote myself to your welfare and your future. Trust me, dear. So I did. She wouldn't let me buy her the expensive engagement ring I wanted to buy. Instead, I signed over to her some of my stock as a betrothal present. I went on voting it, of course. Thinking back, I'm not sure who thought of that present. I worked harder than ever after that, thinking about waste baskets that would empty themselves and a linkage to put dishes away after the dishwasher was through. Everybody was happy. Everybody but Pete and Ricky, that is. Pete ignored Belle, as he did anything he disapproved of but could not change. But Ricky was really unhappy. My fault. Ricky had been my girl since she was a 6-year-old at Sandia, with hair ribbons and big solemn dark eyes. I was going to marry her when she grew up, and we would both take care of Pete. I thought it was a game we were playing, and perhaps it was, with little Ricky serious only to the extent that it offered her eventual full custody of our cat. But how can you tell what goes on in a child's mind? I am not sentimental about kids, little monsters, most of them, who don't civilize until they are grown and sometimes not then. But little Frederica reminded me of my own sister at that age, and besides, she liked Pete and treated him properly. I think she liked me because I never talked down. I had resented that myself as a child, and took her brownie activities seriously. Ricky was okay. She had quiet dignity, and was not a banger, not a squealer, not a lap climber. We were friends, sharing the responsibility for Pete, and, so far as I knew, her being my girl was just a sophisticated game we were playing. I quit playing it after my sister and mother got it the day they bombed us. No conscious decision, I just didn't feel like joking and never went back to it. Ricky was 7 then. She was 10 by the time Belle joined us, and possibly 11 when Belle and I became engaged. She hated Belle with an intensity that I think only I was aware of, since it was expressed only by reluctance to talk to her. Belle called it shyness, and I think Miles thought it was, too. But I knew better and tried to talk Ricky out of it. Did you ever try to discuss with a sub-adolescent something the child does not want to talk about? You'll get more satisfaction shouting in Echo Canyon. I told myself it would wear off as Ricky learned how very lovable Belle was. Pete was another matter, and if I had not been in love, I would have seen it as a clear sign that Belle and I would never understand each other. Belle liked my cat, oh sure, sure. She adored cats, and she loved my incipient bald spot, and admired my choice in restaurants, and she liked everything about me. But liking cats is hard to fake to a cat person. There are cat people, and there are others, more than a majority probably, who cannot abide a harmless, necessary cat. If they try to pretend out of politeness or any other reason, it shows, because they don't understand how to treat cats, and cat protocol is more rigid than that of diplomacy. It is based on self-respect and mutual respect, and it has the same flavor as the dignidad de hombre of Latin America, which you may offend only at risk of your life. Cats have no sense of humor, they have terribly inflated egos, and they are very touchy. If somebody asked me why it was worth anyone's time to cater to them, I would be forced to answer that there is no logical reason. I would rather explain to someone who detests sharp cheeses why he ought to like Limburger. Nevertheless, I fully sympathize with the mandarin who cut off a priceless embroidered sleeve because a kitten was sleeping on it. Belle tried to show that she liked Pete by treating him like a dog, so she got scratched. Then, being a sensible cat, he got out in a hurry and stayed out a long time, which was well, as I would have smacked him, and Pete has never been smacked, not by me. Hitting a cat is worse than useless. A cat can be disciplined only by patience, never by blows. So I put iodine on Belle's scratches, then tried to explain what she had done wrong. I'm sorry it happened. I'm terribly sorry. But it will happen again if you do that again. But I was just petting him.
Yes, but you weren't cat-petting him. You were dog-petting him. You must never pat a cat. You stroke it. You must never make sudden movements in range of its claws. You must never touch it without giving it a chance to see that you are about to, and you must always watch to see that it likes it. If it doesn't want to be petted, it will put up with a little out of politeness. Cats are very polite. But you can tell if it is merely enduring it and stop before its patience is exhausted. I hesitated.
You don't like cats, do you?
What? Why, how silly. Of course I like cats.
But she added, I haven't been around them much, I suppose. She's pretty touchy, isn't she?
He. Pete is a he-male cat.
No, actually he's not touchy, since he's always been well treated. But you do have to learn how to behave with cats.
You must never laugh at them.
What? Forevermore? Why?
Not because they aren't funny. They're extremely comical. But they have no sense of humor, and it offends them. Oh, a cat won't scratch you for laughing. He'll simply stalk off and you'll have trouble making friends with him. But it's not too important. Knowing how to pick up a cat is much more important. When Pete comes back in, I'll show you how. But Pete didn't come back in. Not then, and I never showed her. Belle didn't touch him after that. She spoke to him and acted as if she liked him, but she kept her distance and he kept his. I put it out of my mind. I couldn't let so trivial a thing make me doubt the woman who was more to me than anything in life. But the subject of Pete almost reached a crisis later. Belle and I were discussing where we were going to live. She still wouldn't set the date, but we spent a lot of time on such details. I wanted a ranchette near the plant. She favored a flat in town until we could afford a Bel Air estate. I said, Darling, it's not practical. I've got to be near the plant. Besides, did you ever try to take care of a tomcat in a city apartment?
Oh, that. Look, darling, I'm glad you mentioned it. I've been studying up on cats. I really have. We'll have him altered. Then he'll be much gentler and perfectly happy in a flat.
I stared at her, unable to believe my ears. Make a eunuch of that old warrior? Change him into a fireside decoration?
Belle, you don't know what you're saying.
She tut-tutted me with the old familiar mother knows best, giving the stock arguments of people who mistake cats for property. How it wouldn't hurt him, that it was really for his own good, how she knew how much I valued him, and she would never think of depriving me of him, how it was really very simple and quite safe and better for everybody. I cut in on her.
Why don't you arrange it for both of us?
What, dear?
Me too. I'd be much more docile, and I'd stay home nights, and I'd never argue with you. As you pointed out, it doesn't hurt, and I'd probably be a lot happier.
She turned red. You're being preposterous.
So are you.
She never mentioned it again. Belle never let a difference of opinion degenerate into a row. She shut up and bided her time. But she never gave up, either. In some ways, she had a lot of cat in her, which may have been why I couldn't resist her. I was glad to drop the matter. I was up to here in Flexible Frank. Willie and Hired Girl were bound to make us lots of money, but I had a bee in my bonnet about the perfect all-work household automaton, the general-purpose servant. All right, call it a robot, though that is a much-abused word, and I had no notion of building a mechanical man. I wanted a gadget which could do anything inside the home. Cleaning and cooking, of course, but also really hard jobs, like changing a baby's diaper or replacing a typewriter ribbon. Instead of a stable of hired girls and window willies and nursemaid Nans and houseboy Harrys and gardener Gusses, I wanted a man and wife to be able to buy one machine for, oh, say about the price of a good automobile, which would be the equal of the Chinese servant you read about but no one in my generation had ever seen. If I could do that, it would be the Second Emancipation Proclamation, freeing women from their age-old slavery. I wanted to abolish the old saw about how Women's work is never done. Housekeeping is repetitious and unnecessary drudgery. As an engineer, it offended me. For the problem to be within the scope of one engineer, almost all of Flexible Frank had to be standard parts and must not involve any new principles. Basic research is no job for one man alone. This had to be development from former art, or I couldn't do it. Fortunately, there was an awful lot of former art in engineering, and I had not wasted my time while under a Q clearance. What I wanted wasn't as complicated as the things a guided missile was required to do. Just what did I want Flexible Frank to do? Answer: any work a human being does around a house. He didn't have to play cards, make love, eat, or sleep, but he did have to clean up after the card game, cook, make beds, and tend babies. At least he had to keep track of a baby's breathing and call someone if it changed. I decided he did not have to answer telephone calls, as AT&T was already renting a gadget for that. There was no need for him to answer the door, either, as most new houses were being equipped with door answerers. But to do the multitude of things I wanted him to do, he had to have hands, eyes, ears, and a brain. A good enough brain. Hands I could order from the Atomics Engineering Equipment Companies who supplied hired girls' hands. Only this time I would want the best, with wide-range servos, and with the delicate feedback required for micro-analysis manipulations and for weighing radioactive isotopes. The same companies could supply eyes, only they could be simpler, since Frank would not have to see and manipulate from behind yards of concrete shielding the way they do in a reactor plant. The ears I could buy from any of a dozen radio TV houses, though I might have to do some circuit designing to have his hands controlled simultaneously by sight, sound, and touch feedback, the way the human hand is controlled. But you can do an awful lot in a small space with transistors and printed circuits. Frank wouldn't have to use stepladders. I would make his neck stretch like an ostrich and his arms extend like lazy tongs. Should I make him able to go up and down stairs? Well, there was a powered wheelchair that could. Maybe I should buy one and use it for the chassis, limiting the pilot model to a space no bigger than a wheelchair and no heavier than such a chair could carry. That would give me a set of parameters. I'd tie its power and steering into Frank's brain. The brain was the real hitch. You can build a gadget linked like a man's skeleton, or even much better. You can give it a feedback control system good enough to drive nails, scrub floors, crack eggs, or not crack eggs. But unless it has that stuff between the ears that a man has, it is not a man. It's not even a corpse. Fortunately, I didn't need a human brain. I just wanted a docile moron, capable of largely repetitive household jobs. Here is where the Thorson memory tubes came in. The intercontinental missiles we had struck back with thought, with Thorson tubes, and traffic control systems in places like Los Angeles used an idiot form of them. No need to go into theory of an electronic tube that even Bell Labs doesn't understand too well. The point is that you can hook a Thorson tube into a control circuit, direct the machine through an operation by manual control, and the tube will remember what was done, and can direct the operation without a human supervisor a second time or any number of times. For an automated machine tool, this is enough. For guided missiles and for Flexible Frank, you add side circuits that give the machine judgment. Actually, it isn't judgment. In my opinion, a machine can never have judgment. The side circuit is a hunting circuit, the programming of which says, look for so-and-so within such-and-such limits. When you find it, carry out your basic instruction. The basic instruction can be as complicated as you can crowd into one Thorson memory tube, which is a very wide limit indeed. And you can program so that your judgment circuits, moronic backseat drivers they are, can interrupt the basic instructions any time the cycle does not match that originally impressed into the Thorson tube. This meant that you need cause Flexible Frank to clear the table and scrape the dishes and load them into the dishwasher only once, and from then on he could cope with any dirty dishes he ever encountered. Better still, he could have an electronically duplicated Thorsen tube stuck into his head and could handle dirty dishes the first time he ever encountered them, and never break a dish. Stick another memorized tube alongside the first one, and he could change a wet baby first time and never, never, never stick a pin in the baby. Frank's square head could easily hold 100 Thorsen tubes, each with an electronic memory of a different household task, then throw a guard circuit around all the judgment circuits, a circuit which required him to hold still and squall for help if he ran into something not covered by his instructions. That way you wouldn't use up babies or dishes. So I did build Frank on the framework of a powered wheelchair. He looked like a hat rack making love to an octopus, but boy, how he could polish silverware. Miles looked over the first Frank, watched him mix a martini and serve it, then go around emptying and polishing ashtrays, never touching ones that were clean, open a window and fasten it open, then go to my bookcase and dust and tidy the books in it. Miles took a sip of his martini and said, "Too much vermouth." "It's the way I like them. But we can tell him to fix yours one way and mine another. He's got plenty of blank tubes in him. Flexible." Miles took another sip. "How soon can he be engineered for production?" I'd like to fiddle with him for about 10 years. Before he could groan, I added, "But we ought to be able to put a limited model into production in 5.
"Nonsense. We'll get you plenty of help and have a Model T job ready in 6 months.
"The devil you will! This is my magnum opus. I'm not going to turn him loose until he is a work of art. About a third that size, everything plug-in replaceable but the Thorsens, and so all out flexible that he'll not only wind the cat and wash the baby, he'll even play ping-pong if the buyer wants to pay for the extra programming." I looked at him. Frank was quietly dusting my desk and putting every paper back exactly where he found it. But ping-pong with him wouldn't be much fun. He'd never miss. No, I suppose we could teach him to miss with a random choice circuit. Yes, we could. We will. It would make a nice selling demonstration.
1 year, Dan, and not a day over. I'm going to hire somebody away from Lowy to help you with the styling.
I said, "Miles, when are you going to learn that I boss the engineering? Once I turn him over to you, he's yours, but not a split second before." Miles answered, "It's still too much vermouth." I piddled along with the help of the shop mechanics until I had Frank looking less like a 3-car crash and more like something you might want to brag about to the neighbors. In the meantime, I smoothed a lot of bugs out of his control system. I even taught him to stroke Pete and scratch him under the chin in such a fashion that Pete liked it. And believe me, that takes negative feedback as exact as anything used in atomics labs. Miles didn't crowd me, although he came in from time to time and watched the progress. I did most of my work at night, coming back after dinner with Belle and taking her home. Then I would sleep most of the day, arrive late in the afternoon, sign whatever papers Belle had for me, see what the shop had done during the day, then take Belle out to dinner again. I didn't try to do much before then, because creative work makes a man stink like a goat. After a hard night in the lab shop, nobody could stand me but Pete. Just as we were finishing dinner one day, Belle said to me,
"Going back to the shop, dear?"
"Sure, why not?"
"Good, because Miles is going to meet us there."
"Huh?"
"He wants a stockholders' meeting."
"A stockholders' meeting? Why?"
"It won't take long. Actually, dear, you haven't been paying much attention to the firm's business lately. Miles wants to gather up loose ends and settle some policies."
"I've been sticking close to the engineering. What else am I supposed to do for the firm?"
"Nothing, dear. Miles says it won't take long."
"What's the trouble? Can't Jake handle the assembly line?"
"Please, dear. Miles didn't tell me why. Finish your coffee."
Miles was waiting for us at the plant and shook hands as solemnly as if we had not met in a month. I said, "Miles, what's this all about?" He turned to Belle.
"Get the agenda, will you?"
This alone should have told me that Belle had been lying when she claimed that Miles had not told her what he had in mind. But I did not think of it. Hell, I trusted Belle. And my attention was distracted by something else, for Belle went to the safe, spun the knob, and opened it. I said, "By the way, dear, I tried to open that last night and couldn't. Have you changed the combination?" She was hauling papers out and did not turn. "Didn't I tell you? The patrol asked me to change it after that burglar scare last week." "Oh. You'd better give me the new numbers, or some night I'll have to phone one of you at a ghastly hour."
"Certainly."
She closed the safe and put a folder on the table we used for conferences. Miles cleared his throat and said, "Let's get started." I answered, "Okay. Darling, if this is a formal meeting, I guess you had better make pothooks. Wednesday, November 18th, 1970, 9:20 p.m., all stockholders present. Put our names down. D.B. Davis, chairman of the board and presiding. Any old business?" There wasn't any. "Okay, Miles, it's your show. Any new business?" Miles cleared his throat. "I want to review the firm's policies, present a program for the future, and have the board consider a financing proposal." "Financing? Don't be silly. We're in the black and doing better every month. What's the matter, Miles? Dissatisfied with your drawing account? We could boost it."
"We wouldn't stay in the black under the new program. We need a broader capital structure."
"What new program?"
"Please, Dan. I've gone to the trouble of writing it up in detail. Let Belle read it to us."
"Well, okay." Skipping the gobbledygook, like all lawyers, Miles was fond of polysyllables, Miles wanted to do three things. A. Take Flexible Frank away from me, hand it over to a production engineering team, and get it on the market without delay. B. But I stopped it at that point. "No."
"Wait a minute, Dan. As president and general manager, I'm certainly entitled to present my ideas in an orderly manner. Save your comments. Let Belle finish reading."
"Well, all right. But the answer is still no." Point B was in effect that we should quit frittering around as a one-horse outfit. We had a big thing, as big as the automobile had been, and we were in at the start. Therefore, we should at once expand and set up organization for nationwide and worldwide selling and distribution, with production to match. I started drumming on the table. I could just see myself as chief engineer of an outfit like that. They probably wouldn't even let me have a drafting table, and if I picked up a soldering gun, the union would pull a strike. I might as well have stayed in the army and tried to make general. But I didn't interrupt. Point C was that we couldn't do this on pennies. It would take millions. Mannix Enterprises would put up the dough. What it amounted to was that we would sell out to Mannix, lock, stock, and Flexible Frank, and become a daughter corporation. Miles would stay on as division manager, and I would stay on as chief research engineer. But the free old days would be gone. We'd both be hired hands.
"Is that all?" I said.
Yes. Let's discuss it and take a vote."
"There ought to be something in there granting us the right to sit in front of the cabin at night and sing spirituals."
"This is no joke, Dan. This is how it's got to be."
"I wasn't joking. A slave needs privileges to keep him quiet. Okay, is it my turn?"
"Go ahead."
I put up a counterproposal, one that had been growing in my mind. I wanted us to get out of production. Jake Schmidt, our production shopmaster, was a good man. Nevertheless, I was forever being jerked out of a warm creative fog to straighten out bugs in production, which is like being dumped out of a warm bed into ice water. This was the real reason why I had been doing so much night work and staying away from the shop in the daytime. With more war surplus buildings being moved in and a night shift contemplated, I could see the time coming when I would get no peace to create, even though we turned down this utterly unpalatable plan to rub shoulders with General Motors and Consolidated. I certainly was not twins. I couldn't be both inventor and production manager. So I proposed that we get smaller instead of bigger. License Hired Girl and Window Willie, let someone else build and sell them while we raked in the royalties. When Flexible Frank was ready, we would license him too.
If Mannix wanted the licenses and would outbid the market, swell. Meantime, we'd change our name to Davis and Gentry Research Corporation and hold it down to just the three of us, with a machinist or two to help me jackleg new gadgets. Miles and Bell could sit back and count the money as it rolled in. Miles shook his head slowly. No, Dan. Licensing would make us some money, granted, but not nearly the money we would make if we did it ourselves.
Confound it, Miles! We wouldn't be doing it ourselves. That's just the point. We'd be selling our souls to the Mannix people. As for money, how much do you want? You can only use one yacht or one swimming pool at a time, and you'll have both before the year is out if you want them.
I don't want them.
What do you want?
He looked up. Dan, you want to invent things. This plan lets you do so, with all the facilities and all the help and all the expense money in the world. Me? I want to run a big business. A big business. I've got the talent for it. He glanced at Bell.
I don't want to spend my life sitting out here in the middle of the Mojave Desert acting as business manager to one lonely inventor.
I stared at him.
You didn't talk that way at Sandia. You want out, Pappy? Bell and I would hate to see you go, but if that is the way you feel, I guess I could mortgage the place or something and buy you out. I wouldn't want any man to feel tied down.
I was shocked to my heels, but if old Miles was restless, I had no right to hold him to my pattern.
No, I don't want out. I want us to grow. You heard my proposal. It's a formal motion for action by the corporation. I so move.
I guess I looked puzzled. You insist on doing it the hard way? Okay, Bell, the vote is no. Record it. But I won't put up my counterproposal tonight. We'll talk it over and exchange views. I want you to be happy, Miles.
Miles said stubbornly, Let's do this properly. Roll call, Bell.
Very well, sir. Miles Gentry, voting stock shares number...
She read off the serial numbers.
How say you?
Aye. She wrote it in her book.
Daniel B. Davis, voting stock shares number...
She read off a string of telephone numbers again. I didn't listen to the formality.
How say you?
No, and that settles it. I'm sorry, Miles.
Bell S. Darkin, she went on, voting shares number...
She recited figures again.
I vote aye.
My mouth dropped open. Then I managed to stop gasping and say,
But baby, you can't do that. Those are your shares, sure, but you know perfectly well that...
Announce the tally, Miles growled.
The ayes have it. The proposal is carried.
Record it.
Yes, sir.
The next few minutes were confused. First I yelled at her, then I reasoned with her, then I snarled and told her that what she had done was not honest. True, I had assigned the stock to her, but she knew as well as I did that I always voted it, that I had had no intention of parting with control of the company, that it was an engagement present, pure and simple. Hell, I had even paid the income tax on it last April. If she could pull a stunt like this when we were engaged, what was our marriage going to be like? She looked right at me, and her face was utterly strange to me.
Dan Davis... If you think we are still engaged after the way you have talked to me, you are even stupider than I've always known you were.
She turned to Gentry.
Will you take me home, Miles?
Certainly, my dear.
I started to say something, then shut up and stalked out of there without my hat. It was high time to leave, or I would probably have killed Miles, since I couldn't touch Bell. I didn't sleep, of course. About 4 a.m. I got out of bed, made phone calls, agreed to pay more than it was worth, and by 5:30 was in front of the plant with a pickup truck. I went to the gate, intending to unlock it and drive the truck to the loading dock so that I could run flexible Frank over the tailgate. Frank weighed 400 pounds. There was a new padlock on the gate. I shinnied over, cutting myself on barbed wire. Once inside, the gate would give me no trouble, as there were 100 tools in the shop capable of coping with a padlock. But the lock on the front door had been changed, too.
I was looking at it, deciding whether it was easier to break a window with a tire iron or get the jack out of the trunk and brace it between the door frame and the knob, when somebody shouted, "Hey, you! Hands up!" I didn't put my hands up, but I turned around. A middle-aged man was pointing a hog leg at me big enough to bombard a city. "Who the devil are you?"
"Who are you?"
"I'm Dan Davis, chief engineer of this outfit."
"Oh."
He relaxed a little, but still aimed the field mortar at me.
"Yeah, you match the description, but if you have any identification on you, better let me see it."
"Why should I? I asked who you are."
"Me? Nobody you'd know. Name of Joe Todd with the Desert Protective and Patrol Company. Private license. You ought to know who we are. We've had you folks as clients for the night patrol for months. But tonight I'm on as special guard."
"You are? Then if they gave you a key to the place, use it. I want to get in. And quit pointing that blunderbuss at me." He still kept it leveled at me.
"I couldn't rightly do that, Mr. Davis. First place, I don't have a key. Second place, I had particular orders about you. You aren't to go in. I'll let you out the gate."
"I want the gate opened, all right, but I'm going in." I looked around for a rock to break a window.
"Please, Mr. Davis."
"Huh?"
"I'd hate to see you insist. I really would, because I couldn't chance shooting you in the legs. I ain't a very good shot. I'd have to shoot you in the belly. I've got soft-nosed bullets in this iron. It'd be pretty messy."
I suppose that was what changed my mind, though I would like to think it was something else, i.e. when I looked again through the window I saw that Flexible Frank was not where I had left him. As he let me out the gate, Todd handed me an envelope.
"They said to give this to you if you showed up."
I read it in the cab of the truck. It said, 18 November, 1970. Dear Mr. Davis, at a regular meeting of the Board of Directors held this date, it was voted to terminate all your connection, other than as stockholder, with the corporation, as permitted under paragraph 3 of your contract. It is requested that you stay off company property. Your personal papers and belongings will be forwarded to you by safe means. The Board wishes to thank you for your services and regrets the differences in policy opinion which have forced this step on us. Sincerely yours, Miles Gentry, Chairman of the Board and General Manager, by B.S. Darkin, Secretary Treasurer. I read it twice before I recalled that I had never had any contract with the corporation under which to invoke paragraph 3 or any other paragraph. Later that day, a bonded messenger delivered a package to the motel where I kept my clean underwear. It contained my hat, my desk pen, my other slide rule, a lot of books and personal correspondence, and a number of documents. But it did not contain my notes and drawings for Flexible Frank. Some of the documents were very interesting. My contract, for example. Sure enough, paragraph 3 let them fire me without notice, subject to 3 months' salary. But paragraph 7 was even more interesting. It was the latest form of the yellow dog clause, one in which the employee agrees to refrain from engaging in a competing occupation for 5 years by letting his former employers pay him cash to option his services on a first refusal basis, i.e., I could go back to work any time I wanted just by going, hat in hand, and asking Miles and Bell for a job. Maybe that was why they sent the hat back. But for 5 long years I could not work on household appliances without asking them first. I would rather have cut my throat. There were copies of assignments of all patents duly registered from me to Hired Girl, Inc., for Hired Girl and Window Willie and a couple of minor things. Flexible Frank, of course, had never been patented. Well, I didn't think he had been patented. I found out the truth later. But I had never assigned any patents. I hadn't even formally licensed their use to Hired Girl, Inc. The corporation was my own creature, and there hadn't seemed to be any hurry about it. The last 3 items were my stock shares certificate, those I had not given to Bell, a certified check, and a letter explaining each item of the check. Accumulated salary, less drawing account disbursements, 3 months extra salary in lieu of notice, option money to invoke Paragraph 7, and a $1,000 bonus to express,
appreciation of services rendered. That last was real sweet of them. While I reread that amazing collection, I had time to realize that I had probably not been too bright to sign everything that Bell put in front of me. There was no possible doubt that the signatures were mine. I steadied down enough the next day to talk it over with a lawyer, a very smart and money-hungry lawyer, one who didn't mind kicking and clapper-clawing and biting in the clinches. At first, he was anxious to take it on a contingent fee basis, but after he finished looking over my exhibits and listening to the details, he sat back and laced his fingers over his belly and looked sour. "Dan, I'm going to give you some advice, and it's not going to cost you anything." "Well?" "Do nothing. You haven't got a prayer." "But you said..." "I know what I said. They rooked you. But how can you prove it? They were too smart to steal your stock or cut you off without a penny. They gave you exactly the deal you could have reasonably expected if everything had been kosher and you had quit or had been fired over, as they express it, a difference of policy opinion. They gave you everything you had coming to you, and a measly $1,000 to boot just to show there are no hard feelings. But I didn't have a contract, and I never assigned those patents." "These papers say you did. You admit that's your signature. Can you prove what you say by anyone else?" "I thought about it. I certainly could not. Not even Jake Schmidt knew anything that went on in the front office. The only witnesses I had were Miles and Bell." "Now about that stock assignment," he went on, "that's the one chance to break the logjam. If you..." "But that is the only transaction in the whole stack that really is legitimate. I signed over that stock to her." "Yes, but why? You say that you gave it to her as an engagement present in expectation of marriage. Never mind how she voted it, that's beside the point. If you can prove that it was given as a betrothal gift in full expectation of marriage, and that she knew it when she accepted it, you can force her either to marry you or to disgorge. McNulty versus Rhodes. Then you're in control again and kick them out. Can you prove it?" "Damn it, I don't want to marry her now. I wouldn't have her." "That's your problem. But one thing at a time. Have you any witnesses or any evidence, letters or anything, which would tend to show that she accepted it, understanding that you were giving it to her as your future wife?" I thought. Sure, I had witnesses. The same old two. Miles and Bell. "You see, with nothing but your word against both of theirs, plus a pile of written evidence, you not only won't get anywhere, but you might wind up committed to a Napoleon factory with a diagnosis of paranoia. My advice to you is to get a job in some other line, or at the very most go ahead and buck their yellow dog contract by setting up a competitive business. I'd like to see that phraseology tested as long as I didn't have to fight it myself. But don't charge them with conspiracy. They'll win. Then they'll sue you and clean you out of what they let you keep." He stood up. I took only part of his advice. There was a bar on the ground floor of the same building. I went in and had a couple or nine drinks. I had plenty of time to recall all this while I was driving out to see Miles. Once we had started making money, he had moved Ricky and himself to a nice little rental in San Fernando Valley to get out of the murderous Mojave heat, and had started commuting via the Air Force slot. Ricky wasn't there now, I was happy to recall. She was up at Big Bear Lake at Girl Scout camp. I didn't want to chance Ricky's being witness to a row between me and her stepdaddy. I was bumper to bumper in Sepulveda Tunnel when it occurred to me that it would be smart to get the certificate for my hired girl stock off my person before going to see Miles. I did not expect any rough stuff unless I started it, but it just seemed a good idea. Like a cat who has had his tail caught in the screen door once, I was permanently suspicious. Leave it in the car? Suppose I was hauled in for assault and battery. It wouldn't be smart to have it in the car when the car was towed in and impounded. I could mail it to myself, but I had been getting my mail lately from general delivery at the GPO, while shifting from hotel to hotel as often as they found out I was keeping a cat.
I had better mail it to someone I could trust. But that was a mighty short list. Then I remembered someone I could trust. Ricky. I may seem a glutton for punishment to decide to trust one female just after I had been clipped by another, but the cases are not parallel. I had known Ricky half her life, and if there ever was a human being honest as a Joe Block, Ricky was she, and Pete thought so too. Besides, Ricky didn't have physical specifications capable of warping a man's judgment. Her femininity was only in her face. It hadn't affected her figure yet. When I managed to escape from the logjam in Sepulveda Tunnel, I got off the throughway and found a drugstore. There I bought stamps and a big and a little envelope and some notepaper. I wrote to her, "Dear Ricky Tikki Tavi, I hope to see you soon, but until I do, I want you to keep this inside envelope for me. It's a secret, just between you and me." I stopped and thought. Doggone it, if anything happened to me, oh, even a car crash or anything that can stop breathing, while Ricky had this, eventually it would wind up with Miles and Belle, unless I rigged things to prevent it. I realized as I thought about it that I had subconsciously reached a decision about the cold sleep deal. I wasn't going to take it. Sobering up and the lecture the doc had read me had stiffened my spine. I wasn't going to run away. I was going to stay and fight. And this stock certificate was my best weapon. It gave me the right to examine the books. It entitled me to poke my nose into any and all affairs of the company. If they tried again simply to keep me out with a hired guard, I could go back next time with a lawyer and a deputy sheriff and a court order. I could drag them into court with it, too. Maybe I couldn't win, but I could make a stink and perhaps cause the Mannix people to shy off from buying them out. Maybe I shouldn't send it to Ricky at all. No, if anything happened to me, I wanted her to have it. Ricky and Pete were all the family I had. I went on writing. If by any chance I don't see you for a year, you'll know something has happened to me. If that happens, take care of Pete if you can find him. And without telling anybody, take the inside envelope to a branch of the Bank of America, give it to the trust officer, and tell him to open it. Love and kisses, Uncle Danny. Then I took another sheet and wrote, 3 December 1970, Los Angeles, California. For $1 in hand received and other valuable considerations, I assign... Here I listed legal descriptions and serial numbers of my Hired Girl, Inc. stock shares... to the Bank of America in trust for Frederica Virginia Gentry, and to be reassigned to her on her 21st birthday, and signed it. The intent was clear, and it was the best I could do on a drugstore counter with a jukebox blaring in my ear. It should make sure that Ricky got the stock if anything happened to me, while making darn sure that Miles and Belle could not grab it away from her. But if all went well, I would just ask Ricky to give the envelope back to me when I got around to it. By not using the assignment form printed on the back of the certificate, I avoided all the red tape of having a minor assign it back to me. I could just tear up the separate sheet of paper. I sealed the stock certificate with the note assigning it into the smaller envelope, placed it and the letter to Ricky in the larger envelope, addressed it to Ricky at the Girl Scout camp, stamped it, and dropped it in the box outside the drugstore. I noted that it would be picked up in about 40 minutes and climbed back into my car feeling positively light-hearted, not because I had safeguarded the stock, but because I had solved my greater problems. Well, not solved them, perhaps, but had decided to face them, not run off and crawl in a hole to play Rip Van Winkle, nor try to blot them out again with ethanol in various flavors. Sure, I wanted to see the year 2000, but just by sitting tight, I would see it, when I was 60, and still young enough probably to whistle at the girls. No hurry. Jumping to the next century in one long nap wouldn't be satisfactory to a normal man anyhow. About like seeing the end of a movie without having seen what goes before. The thing to do with the next 30 years was to enjoy them while they unfolded. Then, when I came to the year 2000, I would understand it. In the meantime, I was going to have one lulu of a fight with Miles and Belle. Maybe I wouldn't win, but I would sure let them know they had been in a scrap. Like the times Pete had come home bleeding in six directions, but insisting loudly,
You ought to see the other cat. I didn't expect much out of this interview tonight. All it would amount to was a formal declaration of war. I planned to ruin Miles's sleep, and he could phone Belle and ruin hers.